until the subject was changed. "An engorgement charm, I suppose," said Hermione, halfway between disapproval and amusement. "Well, you've done a good job on them."
"That's what your little sister said," said Hagrid, nodding at Ron. "Met her just yesterday."
Hagrid looked sideways at Harry, his beard twitching.
"Said she was just looking round the grounds, but I reckon she was hoping she might run into someone else at my house."
He winked at Harry.
"If you ask me, she wouldn't say no to a signed..."
"Oh, shut up," said Harry. Ron snorted with laughter, and the ground was sprayed with slugs.
"Watch it,"
Hagrid roared, pulling Ron away from his precious pumpkins. It was nearly lunchtime, and as Harry had only had one bit of treacle fudge since dawn, he was keen to go back to school to eat. They said goodbye to Hagrid and walked back up to the castle, Ron hiccuping occasionally, but only bringing up two very small slugs. They had barely set foot in the cool entrance hall when a voice rang out,
"There you are, Potter! Weasley!"
Professor McGonagall was walking toward them, looking stern.
"You will both do your detentions this evening."
"What are we doing, Professor?" said Ron, nervously suppressing a burp.
"You will be polishing the silver in the trophy room with Mr. Filch," said Professor McGonagall. "No magic, Weasley. Elbow grease."
Ron gulped. Argus Filch, the caretaker, was loathed by every student in the school.
"And you, Potter, will be helping Professor Lockhart answer his fan mail," said Professor McGonagall.
"Oh, no, Professor, can't I go and do the trophy room too?" said Harry desperately.
"Certainly not," said Professor McGonagall, raising her eyebrows. "Professor Lockhart requested you particularly. 8 o'clock sharp, both of you."
Harry and Ron slouched into the great hall in states of deepest gloom, Hermione behind them wearing a well-you-did-break-school-rules sort of expression. Harry didn't enjoy his shepherd's pie as much as he'd thought. Both he and Ron felt they'd got the worst deal.
"Filch'll have me there all night," said Ron heavily. "No magic. There must be about 100 cups in that room. I'm no good at muggle cleaning."
"I'd swap any time," said Harry hollowly. "I've had loads of practice with the Dursleys. Answering Lockhart's fan mail, he'll be a nightmare." Saturday afternoon seemed to melt away, and in what seemed like no time, it was 8:05, and Harry was dragging his feet along the second-floor corridor to Lockhart's office. He gritted his teeth and knocked. The door flew open at once. Lockhart beamed down at him.
"Ah, here's a scallywag," he said. "Come in, Harry, come in."
Shining brightly on the walls by the light of many candles were countless framed photographs of Lockhart. He had even signed a few of them. Another large pile lay on his desk.
"You can address the envelopes," Lockhart told Harry as though this was a huge treat. "This first one's to Gladys Gudgeon. Bless her, huge fan of mine."
The minutes snailed by. Harry let Lockhart's voice wash over him, occasionally saying, "Right, yeah." Now and then he caught a phrase like, "Fame's a fickle friend, Harry," or "Celebrity is as celebrity does. Remember that?" The candles burned lower and lower, making the light dance over the many moving faces of Lockhart watching him. Harry moved his aching hand over what felt like the 1,000th envelope, writing out Veronica Smedley's address.
"It must be nearly time to leave," Harry thought miserably. "Please let it be nearly time."
And then he heard something. Something quite apart from the spitting of the dying candles and Lockhart's prattle about his fans. It was a voice to chill the bone marrow, a voice of breathtaking, ice-cold venom.
"Come, come to me. Let me rip you. Let me tear you. Let me kill you."
Harry gave a huge jump, and a large lilac blot appeared on Veronica Smethley's street.
"What?"
he said loudly.
"I know," said Lockhart. 6 solid months at the top of the bestseller list. Broke all records."
"No," said Harry frantically. "That voice."
"Sorry,"
said Lockhart, looking puzzled.
"What voice?"
That voice that said... "Didn't you hear it?"
Lockhart was looking at Harry in high astonishment.
What are you talking about, Harry? Perhaps you're getting a little drowsy.
Great Scott, look at the time. We've been here nearly 4 hours.
I'd never have believed it. The time's flown, hasn't it?
Harry didn't answer. He was straining his ears to hear the voice again. But there was no sound now except for Lockhart telling him he mustn't expect to treat like this every time he got detention. Feeling dazed, Harry left. It was so late that the Gryffindor common room was almost empty. Harry went straight up to the dormitory. Ron wasn't back yet. Harry pulled on his pajamas, got into bed, and waited. Half an hour later, Ron arrived, nursing his right arm and bringing a strong smell of polish into the darkened room.
"My muscles are all seized up," he groaned, sinking on his bed.
14 times he made me buff up that Quidditch cup before he was satisfied, and then I had another slug attack all over a special awards for services to the school. Took ages to get the slime off. How was it with Lockhart?
Keeping his voice low so as not to wake Neville, Dean, and Seamus, Harry told Ron exactly what he had heard.
"And Lockhart said he couldn't hear it?" said Ron.
Harry could see him frowning in the moonlight.
"Do you think he was lying? But I don't get it. Even someone invisible would have had to open the door."
"I know," said Harry, lying back in his four-poster and staring at the canopy above him.
"I don't get it either."
Chapter 8, The Death Day Party. October arrived, spreading a damp chill over the grounds and into the castle. Madame Pomfrey, the nurse, was kept busy by a sudden spate of colds among the staff and students. Her pepper-up potion worked instantly, though it left the drinker smoking at the ears for several hours afterward. Ginny Weasley, who had been looking pale, was bullied into taking some by Percy. The steam pouring from under her vivid hair gave the impression that her whole head was on fire. Raindrops the size of bullets thundered on the castle windows for days on end. The lake rose, the flower beds turned into muddy streams, and Hagrid's pumpkins swelled to the size of garden sheds. Oliver Wood's enthusiasm for regular training sessions, however, was not dampened, which was why Harry was to be found late one stormy Saturday afternoon, a few days before Halloween, returning to Gryffindor Tower, drenched to the skin and splattered with mud. Even aside from the rain and wind, it hadn't been a happy practice session. Fred and George, who had been spying on the Slytherin team, had seen for themselves the speed of those new Nimbus 2001s. They reported that the Slytherin team was no more than 7 greenish blurs shooting through the air like missiles. As Harry squelched along the deserted corridor, he came across somebody who looked just as preoccupied as he was. Nearly headless Nick, the ghost of Gryffindor Tower, was staring morosely out of a window, muttering under his breath,
"Don't fulfill their requirements. Half an inch, if that."
"Hello, Nick," said Harry.
"Hello, hello,"
said nearly headless Nick, starting and looking around. He wore a dashing plumed hat on his long curly hair, and a tunic with a ruff, which concealed the fact that his neck was almost completely severed. He was pale as smoke, and Harry could see right through him to the dark sky and torrential rain outside.
"You look troubled, young Potter," said Nick, folding a transparent letter as he spoke and tucking it inside his doublet.
"So do you," said Harry.
"Ah,"
nearly headless Nick waved an elegant hand.
"A matter of no importance. It's not as though I really wanted to join. Thought I'd apply, but apparently I don't fulfill requirements."
In spite of his airy tone, there was a look of great bitterness on his face.
"But you would think, wouldn't you,"
he erupted suddenly, pulling the letter back out of his pocket,
"that getting hit 45 times in the neck with a blunt axe would qualify you to join the Headless Hunt."
"Oh, yes," said Harry, who was obviously supposed to agree.
"I mean, nobody wishes more than I do that it had all been quick and clean, and my head had come off properly. I mean, it would have saved me a great deal of pain and ridicule, however."
Nearly headless Nick shook his letter open and read furiously.
We can only accept huntsmen whose heads have parted company with their bodies. You will appreciate that it would be impossible otherwise for members to participate in hunt activities such as horseback head juggling and head polo. It is with the greatest regret, therefore, that I must inform you that you do not fulfill our requirements. With very best wishes, Sir Patrick Delaney-Podmore.
Fuming, nearly headless Nick stuffed the letter away.
Half an inch of skin and sinew holding my neck on, Harry. Most people would think that's good and beheaded, but oh no, it's not enough for Sir Properly Decapitated Podmore.
Nearly headless Nick took several deep breaths and then said in a far calmer tone,
"So, what's bothering you? Anything I can do?"
"No," said Harry, "not unless you know where we can get 7 free Nimbus 2001s for our match against Slither."
The rest of Harry's sentence was drowned out by a high-pitched mewling from somewhere near his ankles. He looked down and found himself gazing into a pair of lamp-like yellow eyes. It was Mrs. Norris, the skeletal grey cat who was used by the caretaker, Argus Filch, as a sort of deputy in his endless battle against students.
"You'd better get out of here, Harry," said Nick quickly. "Filch isn't in a good mood. He's got the flu, and some third years accidentally plastered frog brains all over the ceiling in Dungeon 5. He's been cleaning all morning, and if he sees you dripping mud all over the place..."
"Right," said Harry, backing away from the accusing stare of Mrs. Norris, but not quickly enough. Drawn to the spot by the mysterious power that seemed to connect him with his foul cat, Argus Filch burst suddenly through a tapestry to Harry's right, wheezing and looking wildly about for the rule-breaker. There was a thick tartan scarf bound around his head, and his nose was unusually purple.
"Filth!" he shouted, his jowls a-quiver, his eyes popping alarmingly as he pointed at the muddy puddle that had dripped from Harry's Quidditch robes. "Mess and muck everywhere. I've had enough of it. I tell you, follow me, Potter."
So Harry waved a gloomy goodbye to nearly headless Nick and followed Filch back downstairs, doubling the number of muddy footprints on the floor. Harry had never been inside Filch's office before. It was a place most students avoided. The room was dingy and windowless, lit by a single oil lamp dangling from the low ceiling. A faint smell of fried fish lingered about the place. Wooden filing cabinets stood around the walls. From their labels, Harry could see that they contained details of every pupil Filch had ever punished. Fred and George Weasley had an entire drawer to themselves. A highly polished collection of chains and manacles hung on the wall behind Filch's desk. It was common knowledge that he was always begging Dumbledore to let him suspend students by their ankles from the ceiling. Filch grabbed a quill from a pot on his desk and began shuffling around looking for parchment.
"Dung," he muttered furiously. "Great sizzling dragon bogies. Frog brains. Rat intestines. I've had enough of it. Make an example. Where's the form? Yes."
He retrieved a large roll of parchment from his desk drawer and stretched it out in front of him, dipping his long black quill into the inkpot.
"Name? Harry Potter. Crime?"
"It was only a bit of mud," said Harry.
"It's only a bit of mud to you, boy, but to me it's an extra hour of scrubbing," shouted Filch, a drip shivering unpleasantly at the end of his bulbous nose. "Crime? Befouling the castle. Suggested sentence?"
Dabbing at his streaming nose, Filch squinted unpleasantly at Harry, who waited with bated breath for his sentence to fall. But as Filch lowered his quill, there was a great bang on the ceiling of the office, which made the oil lamp rattle.
"Peeves!" Filch roared, flinging down his quill in a transport of rage. "I'll have you this time. I'll have you."
And without a backward glance at Harry, Filch ran flat-footed from the office, Mrs. Norris streaking alongside him. Peeves was the school poltergeist, a grinning, airborne menace who lived to cause havoc and distress. Harry didn't much like Peeves, but couldn't help feeling grateful for his timing. Hopefully, whatever Peeves had done, and it sounded as though he'd wrecked something very big this time, would distract Filch from Harry. Thinking that he should probably wait for Filch to come back, Harry sank into a moth-eaten chair next to the desk. There was only one thing on it apart from his half-completed form, a large, glossy purple envelope with silver lettering on the front. With a quick glance at the door to check that Filch wasn't on his way back, Harry picked up the envelope and read, "Quick Spell, a correspondence course in beginner's magic." Intrigued, Harry flicked the envelope open and pulled out the sheaf of parchment inside. More curly silver writing on the front page said, "Feel out of step in the world of modern magic? Find yourself making excuses not to perform simple spells? Ever been taunted for your woeful wand work? There is an answer. Quick Spell is an all-new, fail-safe, quick-result, easy-learn course. Hundreds of witches and wizards have benefited from the Quick Spell method. Madam Z. Nettles of Topsham writes, "I had no memory for incantations and my potions were a family joke. Now, after a quick spell course, I am the center of attention at parties and friends beg for the recipe of my scintillation solution." Warlock DJ Prod of Didsbury says, "My wife used to sneer at my feeble charms, but 1 month into your fabulous quick spell course and I succeeded in turning her into a yak. Thank you, Quick Spell." Fascinated, Harry thumbed through the rest of the envelope's contents. Why on earth did Filch want a quick spell course? Did this mean he wasn't a proper wizard? Harry was just reading, "Lesson 1, Holding Your Wand, Some Useful Tips," when shuffling footsteps outside told him Filch was coming back. Stuffing the parchment back into the envelope, Harry threw it back onto the desk just as the door opened. Filch was looking triumphant. "That vanishing cabinet was extremely valuable," he was saying gleefully to Mrs. Norris. "We'll have Peeves out this time, my sweet." His eyes fell on Harry and then darted to the quick spell envelope, which, Harry realized too late, was lying 2 feet away from where it had started. Filch's pasty face went brick red. Harry braced himself for a tidal wave of fury. Filch hobbled across to his desk, snatched up the envelope, and threw it into a drawer. "Have you... did you read..." he spluttered. "No," Harry lied quickly. Filch's knobbly hands were twisting together. "If I thought you'd read my private... not that it's mine. For a friend. Be that as it may. However..." Harry was staring at him, alarmed. Filch had never looked madder. His eyes were popping. A tick was going in one of his pouchy cheeks, and the tartan scarf didn't help. "Very well, go, and don't breathe a word. Not that... however, if you didn't read... go now. I have to write up Peeves' report. Go!" Amazed at his luck, Harry sped out of the office, up the corridor, and back upstairs. To escape from Filch's office without punishment was probably some kind of school record.
"Harry! Harry! Did it work?"
Nearly headless Nick came gliding out of a classroom. Behind him, Harry could see the wreckage of a large black and gold cabinet that appeared to have been dropped from a great height.
"I persuaded Peeves to crash it right over Filch's office," said Nick eagerly. "Thought it might distract him."
"Was that you?" said Harry gratefully. "Yeah, it worked. I didn't even get detention. Thanks, Nick."
They set off up the corridor together. Nearly headless Nick, Harry noticed, was still holding Sir Patrick's rejection letter.
"I wish there was something I could do for you about the headless hunt," Harry said.
Nearly headless Nick stopped in his tracks, and Harry walked right through him. He wished he hadn't. It was like stepping through an icy shower.
"But there is something you could do for me," said Nick excitedly. "Harry, would I be asking too much? But no, you wouldn't want."
"What is it?" said Harry.
"Well, this Halloween will be my 500th death day," said Nearly Headless Nick, drawing himself up and looking dignified.
"Oh," said Harry, not sure whether he should look sorry or happy about this.
"Right. I'm holding a party down in one of the roomier dungeons. Friends will be coming from all over the country. It would be such an honor if you would attend. Mr. Weasley and Miss Granger would be most welcome too, of course, but I dare say you'd rather go to the school feast."
He watched Harry on tenderhooks.
"No," said Harry quickly. "I'll come, my dear boy. Harry Potter at my death day party. And..." He hesitated, looking excited. Do you think you could possibly mention to Sir Patrick how very frightening and impressive you find me?
Of course, said Harry.
Nearly headless Nick beamed at him.
A death day party?
Said Hermione keenly, when Harry had changed at last and joined her and Ron in the common room.
I bet there aren't many living people who can say they've been to one of those. It'll be fascinating.
Why would anyone want to celebrate the day they died? Said Ron, who was halfway through his potions homework and grumpy. Sounds dead depressing to me. Rain was still lashing the windows, which were now inky black, but inside all looked bright and cheerful. The firelight glowed over the countless squashy armchairs where people sat reading, talking, doing homework, or, in the case of Fred and George Weasley, trying to find out what would happen if you fed a filibuster firework to a salamander. Fred had rescued the brilliant orange fire-dwelling lizard from a Care of Magical Creatures class, and it was now smoldering gently on a table, surrounded by a knot of curious people. Harry was at the point of telling Ron and Hermione about Filch and the quickspell course when the salamander suddenly whizzed into the air, emitting loud sparks and bangs as it whirled wildly round the room. The sight of Percy bellowing himself hoarse at Fred and George, the spectacular display of tangerine stars showering from the salamander's mouth, and its escape into the fire with accompanying explosions drove both Filch and the quickspell envelope from Harry's mind. By the time Halloween arrived, Harry was regretting his rash promise to go to the Death Day party. The rest of the school was happily anticipating their Halloween feast. The great hall had been decorated with the usual live bats. Hagrid's vast pumpkins had been carved into lanterns large enough for three men to sit in, and there were rumours that Dumbledore had booked a troupe of dancing skeletons for the entertainment.
A promise is a promise,
Hermione reminded Harry bossily. You said you'd go to the Death Day party. So at 7 o'clock, Harry, Ron, and Hermione walked straight past the doorway to the packed great hall, which was glittering invitingly with gold plates and candles, and directed their steps instead toward the dungeons. The passageway leading to Nearly Headless Nick's party had been lined with candles too, though the effect was far from cheerful. These were long, thin, jet-black tapers, all burning bright blue, casting a dim, ghostly light even over their own living faces. The temperature dropped with every step they took. As Harry shivered and drew his robes tightly around him, he heard what sounded like a thousand fingernails scraping an enormous blackboard.
"Is that supposed to be music?"
Ron whispered. They turned a corner and saw Nearly Headless Nick standing at a doorway hung with black velvet drapes.
My dear friends, he said mournfully, welcome, welcome, so pleased you could come.
He swept off his plumed hat and bowed them inside. It was an incredible sight. The dungeon was full of hundreds of pearly white translucent people, mostly drifting around a crowded dance floor, waltzing to the dreadful quavering sound of 30 musical saws played by an orchestra on a raised black-draped platform. A chandelier overhead blazed midnight blue with a thousand more black candles. Their breath rose in a mist before them. It was like stepping into a freezer.
Shall we have a look around?
Harry suggested, wanting to warm up his feet.
Careful not to walk through anyone, said Ron nervously, and they set off around the edge of the dance floor.
They passed a group of gloomy nuns, a ragged man wearing chains, and the fat friar, a cheerful Hufflepuff ghost who was talking to a knight with an arrow sticking out of his forehead. Harry wasn't surprised to see that the bloody Baron, a gaunt, staring, slithering ghost, covered in silver bloodstains, was being given a wide berth by the other ghosts.
"Oh, no," said Hermione, stopping abruptly. "Turn back, turn back. I don't want to talk to Moaning Myrtle."
"Who?" said Harry as they backtracked quickly.
"She haunts one of the toilets in the girls' bathroom on the first floor," said Hermione.
"She haunts a toilet?"
Yes, it's been out of order all year because she keeps having tantrums and flooding the place. I never went in there anyway if I could avoid it. It's awful trying to have a pee with her wailing at you.
Look, food, said Ron. On the other side of the dungeon was a long table, also covered in black velvet. They approached it eagerly, but next moment had stopped in their tracks, horrified. The smell was quite disgusting. Large, rotten fish were laid on handsome silver platters. Cakes, burnt charcoal black, were heaped on salvers. There was a great maggoty haggis, a slab of cheese covered in furry green mould, and, in pride of place, an enormous grey cake in the shape of a tombstone, with tar-like icing forming the words, Sir Nicholas de Mimsey-Porpington died 31st October 1492. Harry watched, amazed, as a portly ghost approached the table, crouched low, and walked through it, his mouth held wide so that it passed through one of the stinking salmon. "Can you taste it if you walk through it?" Harry asked him.
"Almost,"
said the ghost sadly, as he drifted away. "I expect they've let it rot to give it a stronger flavor," said Hermione knowledgeably, pinching her nose and leaning closer to look at the putrid haggis. "Can we move? I feel sick," said Ron. They had barely turned around, however, when a little man swooped suddenly from under the table and came to a halt in mid-air before them. "Hello, Peeves," said Harry cautiously. Unlike the ghosts around them, Peeves, the poltergeist, was the very reverse of pale and transparent. He was wearing a bright orange party hat, a revolving bow tie, and a broad grin on his wide, wicked face.
"Nibbles," he said sweetly, offering them a bowl of peanuts covered in fungus.
"No thanks," said Hermione.
"Heard you talking about poor Myrtle," said Peeves, his eyes dancing. "Rude you was about poor Myrtle."
He took a deep breath and bellowed,
"Oi, Myrtle!"
"Oh, no, Peeves, don't tell her what I said. She'll be really upset," Hermione whispered frantically. "I didn't mean it. I don't mind her. Hello, Myrtle."
The swat ghost of a girl had glided over. She had the glummest face Harry had ever seen, half hidden behind lank hair and thick, pearly spectacles.
"What?"
she said sulkily.
"How are you, Myrtle?" said Hermione in a falsely bright voice. "It's nice to see you out of the toilet."
Myrtle sniffed.
"Miss Granger was just talking about you,"
said Peeves slyly in Myrtle's ear.
"Just saying how nice you look tonight,"
said Hermione, glaring at Peeves. Myrtle eyed Hermione suspiciously.
"You're making fun of me,"
she said, silver tears welling rapidly in her small, see-through eyes.
"No, honestly, didn't I just say how nice Myrtle's looking?"
said Hermione, nudging Harry and Ron painfully in the ribs.
"Oh, yeah?"
"She did."
"Don't lie to me,"
Myrtle gasped, tears now flooding down her face, while Peeves chuckled happily over her shoulder.
"Do you think I don't know what people call me behind my back? Fat Myrtle, ugly Myrtle, miserable moaning, moping Myrtle."
"You've forgotten Pimply,"
Peeves hissed in her ear. Moaning Myrtle burst into anguished sobs and fled from the dungeon. Peeves shot after her, pelting her with mouldy peanuts, yelling,
"Pimply! Pimply!"
"Oh, dear,"
said Hermione sadly. Nearly headless Nick now drifted toward them through the crowd.
"Enjoying yourselves?"
"Oh, yes," they lied.
"Not a bad turnout," said Nearly Headless Nick proudly. "The Wailing Widow came all the way up from Kent. It's nearly time for my speech. I'd better go and warn the orchestra."
The orchestra, however, stopped playing at that very moment. They and everyone else in the dungeon fell silent, looking around in excitement as a hunting horn sounded.
"Oh, here we go," said Nearly Headless Nick bitterly.
Through the dungeon wall burst a dozen ghost horses, each ridden by a headless horseman. The assembly clapped wildly. Harry started to clap too, but stopped quickly at the sight of Nick's face. The horses galloped into the middle of the dance floor and halted, rearing and plunging. At the front of the pack was a large ghost who held his bearded head under his arm, from which position he was blowing the horn. The ghost leapt down, lifted his head high in the air so that he could see over the crowd. Everyone laughed and strode over to Nearly Headless Nick, squashing his head back onto his neck.
"Nick!" he roared. "How How are you? Head still hanging in there?
He gave a hearty guffaw and clapped Nearly Headless Nick on the shoulder.
Welcome, Patrick, said Nick stiffly.
Livens, said Sir Patrick, spotting Harry, Ron and Hermione, and giving a huge, fake jump of astonishment so that his head fell off again. The crowd howled with laughter.
Very amusing, said Nearly Headless Nick darkly.
Don't mind Nick, shouted Sir Patrick's head from the floor. Still upset we won't let him join the hunt, but I mean to say, look at the fellow.
I think, said Harry hurriedly, at a meaningful look from Nick, Nick's very frightening, and,
Ha! Yelled Sir Patrick's head. Betty asked you to say that.
If I could have everyone's attention, it's time for my speech, said Nearly Headless Nick loudly, striding toward the podium and climbing into an icy blue spotlight. My late lamented lords, ladies and gentlemen, it is my great sorrow.
But nobody heard much more. Sir Patrick and the rest of the Headless Hunt had just started a game of head hockey, and the crowd were turning to watch. Nearly Headless Nick tried vainly to recapture his audience, but gave up as Sir Patrick's head went sailing past him to loud cheers. Harry was very cold by now, not to mention hungry.
I can't stand much more of this,
Ron muttered, his teeth chattering, as the orchestra ground back into action and the ghosts swept back onto the dance floor.
Let's go, Harry agreed.
They backed toward the door, nodding and beaming at anyone who looked at them, and a minute later they were hurrying back up the passageway full of black candles.
Pudding might not be finished yet, said Ron, hopefully, leading the way toward the steps to the entrance hall.
And then Harry heard it.
Rip. Tear.
It was the same voice, the same cold, murderous voice he had heard in Lockhart's office. He stumbled to a halt, clutching at the stone wall, listening with all his might, looking around, squinting up and down the dimly lit passageway.
Harry, what you... It's that voice again. Shut up a minute.
So hungry for so long.
Listen, said Harry urgently, and Ron and Hermione froze, watching him. Kill. Time to kill.
The voice was growing fainter. Harry was sure it was moving away, moving upward. A mixture of fear and excitement gripped him as he stared at the dark ceiling.
How could it be moving upward? Was it a phantom to whom stone ceilings didn't matter?
This way, he shouted, and he began to run up the stairs into the entrance hall. It was no good hoping to hear anything here. The babble of talk from the Halloween feast was echoing out of the great hall. Harry sprinted up the marble staircase to the first floor, Ron and Hermione clattering behind him.
Harry, what with...
Shh! Harry strained his ears. Distantly from the floor above and growing fainter still, he heard the voice.
I smell blood. I smell blood.
His stomach lurched.
It's going to kill someone, he shouted,
and ignoring Ron's and Hermione's bewildered faces, he ran up the next flight of steps, three at a time, trying to listen over his own pounding footsteps. Harry hurtled round the whole of the second floor, Ron and Hermione panting behind him, not stopping until they turned a corner into the last deserted passage.
"Harry, what was that all about?" said Ron, wiping sweat off his face. "I couldn't hear anything."
But Hermione gave a sudden gasp, pointing down the corridor.
"Look!"
Something was shining on the wall ahead. They approached slowly, squinting through the darkness. Foot-high words had been daubed on the wall between two windows, shimmering in the light cast by the flaming torches. The Chamber of Secrets has been opened. Enemies of the air, beware.
What's that thing hanging underneath? Said Ron, a slight quiver in his voice.
As they edged nearer, Harry almost slipped. There was a large puddle of water on the floor. Ron and Hermione grabbed him, and they inched toward the message, eyes fixed on a dark shadow beneath it.
All three of them realized what it was at once and leapt backward with a splash. Mrs. Norris, the caretaker's cat, was hanging by her tail from the torch bracket. She was stiff as a board, her eyes wide and staring. For a few seconds, they didn't move. Then Ron said, "Let's get out of here."
"Shouldn't we try and help?"
Harry began awkwardly.
"Trust me," said Ron, "we don't want to be found here."
But it was too late. A rumble, as though of distant thunder, told them that the feast had just ended. From either end of the corridor where they stood came the sound of hundreds of feet climbing the stairs and the loud, happy talk of well-fed people. Next moment, students were crashing into the passage from both ends. The chatter, the bustle, the noise died suddenly as the people in front spotted the hanging cat. Harry, Ron, and Hermione stood alone in the middle of the corridor as silence fell among the mass of students pressing forward to see the grisly sight. Then someone shouted through the quiet,
"Enemies of the air, beware. You'll be next, mudbloods."
It was Draco Malfoy. He had pushed to the front of the crowd, his cold eyes alive, his usually bloodless face flushed as he grinned at the sight of the hanging, immobile cat. Chapter 9, The Writing on the Wall.
"What's going on here? What's going on?"
Attracted, no doubt, by Malfoy's shout, Argus Filch came shouldering his way through the crowd. Then he saw Mrs. Norris and fell back, clutching his face in horror.
"My cat! My cat! What's happened to Mrs. Norris?"
he shrieked. And his popping eyes fell on Harry.
"You!"
he screeched.
"You! You've murdered my cat! You've killed her! I'll kill you! I'll..."
"Argus!" Dumbledore had arrived on the scene, followed by a number of other teachers. In seconds, he had swept past Harry, Ron, and Hermione, and detached Mrs. Norris from the torch bracket.
"Come with me, Argus," he said to Filch. "You too, Mr. Potter, Mr. Weasley, Miss Granger."
Lockhart stepped forward eagerly.
"My office is nearest, headmaster, just upstairs. Please feel free." "Thank you, Gilderoy," said Dumbledore.
The silent crowd parted to let them pass. Lockhart, looking excited and important, hurried after Dumbledore. So did Professors McGonagall and Snape. As they entered Lockhart's darkened office, there was a flurry of movement across the walls. Harry saw several of the Lockharts in the pictures dodging out of sight, their hair in rollers. The real Lockhart lit the candles on his desk and stood back. Dumbledore lay Mrs. Norris on the polished surface and began to examine her. Harry, Ron, and Hermione exchanged tense looks and sank into chairs outside the pool of candlelight, watching. The tip of Dumbledore's long, crooked nose was barely an inch from Mrs. Norris's fur. He was looking at her closely through his half-moon spectacles, his long fingers gently prodding and poking. Professor McGonagall was bent almost as close, her eyes narrowed. Snape loomed behind them, half in shadow, wearing a most peculiar expression. It was as though he was trying hard not to smile. And Lockhart was hovering around all of them, making suggestions.
"It was definitely a curse that killed her. Probably the transmogrifian torture. I've seen it used many times. So unlucky I wasn't there. I know the very counter-curse that would have saved her."
Lockhart's comments were punctuated by Filch's dry, racking sobs. He was slumped in a chair by the desk, unable to look at Mrs. Norris, his face in his hands. Much as he detested Filch, Harry couldn't help feeling a bit sorry for him, though not nearly as sorry as he felt for himself. If Dumbledore believed Filch, he would be expelled for sure. Dumbledore was now muttering strange words under his breath and tapping Mrs. Norris with his wand. But nothing happened. She continued to look as though she had been recently stuffed.
"I remember something very similar happening in Ouagadougou," said Lockhart. "A series of attacks. The full story's in my autobiography. I was able to provide the townsfolk with various amulets, which cleared the matter up at once."
The photographs of Lockhart on the walls were all nodding in agreement as he talked. One of them had forgotten to remove his hairnet. At last Dumbledore straightened up.
"She's not dead, Argus," he said softly. Lockhart stopped abruptly in the middle of counting the number of murders he had prevented.
"Not dead?"
choked Filch, looking through his fingers at Mrs. Norris. "But why is she all stiff and frozen?"
"She has been petrified," said Dumbledore.
"Ah, I thought so," said Lockhart. "But how, I cannot say."
"Ask him,"
shrieked Filch, turning his blotched and tear-stained face to Harry.
"No second year could have done this," said Dumbledore firmly. "It would take dark magic of the most advanced."
"He did it! He did it!"
Filch spat, his pouchy face purpling.
"You saw what he wrote on the wall. He found, in my office. He knows I'm a...
Filch's face worked horribly.
"He knows I'm a squib," he finished.
"I never touched Mrs. Norris," Harry said loudly, uncomfortably aware of everyone looking at him, including all the Lockharts on the walls. "And I don't even know what a squib is."
"Rubbish," snarled Filch. "He saw my quick spell letter."
"If I might speak, headmaster," said Snape from the shadows, and Harry's sense of foreboding increased. He was sure nothing Snape had to say was going to do him any good.
"Potter and his friends may have simply been in the wrong place at the wrong time," he said, a slight sneer curling his mouth as though he doubted it. "But we do have a set of suspicious circumstances here. Why was he in the upstairs corridor at all? Why wasn't he at the Halloween feast?" Harry, Ron, and Hermione all launched into an explanation about the Death Day party. "There were hundreds of ghosts. They'll tell you we were there."
"But why not join the feast afterward?" said Snape, his black eyes glittering in the candlelight. "Why go up to that corridor?"
Ron and Hermione looked at Harry.
Because,
Harry said, his heart thumping very fast. Something told him it would sound very far-fetched if he told them he had been led there by a bodiless voice no one but he could hear.
"Because we were tired and wanted to go to bed," he said.
"Without any supper?"
said Snape, a triumphant smile flittering across his gaunt face.
"I didn't think ghosts provided food fit for living people at their parties."
"We weren't hungry," said Ron, loudly, as his stomach gave a huge rumble. Snape's nasty smile widened.
"I suggest, headmaster, that Potter is not being entirely truthful," he said. "It might be a good idea if he were deprived of certain privileges until he's ready to tell us the whole story. I personally feel he should be taken off the Gryffindor Quidditch team until he is ready to be honest."
"Really, Severus," said Professor McGonagall sharply. "I see no reason to stop the boy playing Quidditch. This cat wasn't hit over the head with a broomstick. There is no evidence at all that Potter has done anything wrong."
Dumbledore was giving Harry a searching look. His twinkling light blue gaze made Harry feel as though he were being X-rayed.
"Innocent until proven guilty, Severus," he said firmly.
Snape looked furious. So did Filch.
"My cat has been petrified," he shrieked, his eyes popping. "I want to see some punishment."
"We will be able to cure her, Argus," said Dumbledore patiently. "Professor Sprout recently managed to procure some mandrakes. As soon as they have reached their full size, I will have a potion made that will revive Mrs. Norris."
"I'll make it," Lockhart butted in. "I must have done it 100 times. I could whip up a mandrake restorative draught in my sleep."
"Excuse me," said Snape icily, "but I believe I am the potions master at this school."
There was a very awkward pause.
"You may go,"
Dumbledore said to Harry, Ron, and Hermione. They went as quickly as they could, without actually running. When they were a floor up from Lockhart's office, they turned into an empty classroom and closed the door quietly behind them. Harry squinted at his friends' darkened faces.
"Do you think I should have told them about that voice I heard?"
"No," said Ron, without hesitation. "Hearing voices no one else can hear isn't a good sign, even in the wizarding world." Something in Ron's voice made Harry ask,
You do believe me, don't you?
Of course I do, said Ron quickly, but you must admit it's weird.
I know it's weird, said Harry. The whole thing's weird. What was that writing on the wall about? The chamber has been opened. What's that supposed to mean?
You know, it rings a sort of bell, said Ron slowly. I think someone told me a story about a secret chamber at Hogwarts once. Might have been Bill.
And what on earth's a squib? Said Harry.
To his surprise, Ron stifled a snigger.
Well, it's not funny, really. But as it's Filch, he said, a squib is someone who was born into a wizarding family but hasn't got any magic powers. Kind of the opposite of muggle-born wizards. But squibs are quite unusual. If Filch is trying to learn magic from a quick spell course, I reckon he must be a squib. It would explain a lot, like why he hates students so much.
Ron gave a satisfied smile.
He's bitter.
A clock chimed somewhere. Midnight, said Harry. We'd better go to bed before Snape comes along and tries to frame us for something else. For a few days, the school could talk of little else but the attack on Mrs. Norris. Filch kept it fresh in everyone's minds by pacing the spot where she had been attacked, as though he thought the attacker might come back. Harry had seen him scrubbing the message on the wall with Mrs. Scour's all-purpose magical mess remover. But to no effect. The words still gleamed as brightly as ever on the stone. When Filch wasn't guarding the scene of the crime, he was skulking red-eyed through the corridors, lunging out at unsuspecting students and trying to put them in detention for things like breathing loudly and looking happy. Ginny Weasley seemed very disturbed by Mrs. Norris's fate. According to Ron, she was a great cat lover.
"But you haven't really got to know Mrs. Norris," Ron told her bracingly. "Honestly, we're much better off without her."
Ginny's lip trembled.
"Stuff like this doesn't often happen at Hogwarts," Ron assured her. "They'll catch the maniac who did it and have him out of here in no time. I just hope he's got time to petrify Filch before he's expelled."
"I'm only joking," Ron added hastily as Ginny blanched. The attack had also had an effect on Hermione. It was quite usual for Hermione to spend a lot of time reading, but she was now doing almost nothing else. Nor could Harry and Ron get much response from her when they asked what she was up to, and not until the following Wednesday did they find out. Harry had been held back in potions, where Snape had made him stay behind to scrape tube worms off the desk. After a hurried lunch, he went upstairs to meet Ron in the library and saw Justin Finch-Fletchley, the Hufflepuff boy from Herbology, coming toward him. Harry had just opened his mouth to say hello when Justin caught sight of him, turned abruptly, and sped off in the opposite direction. Harry found Ron at the back of the library, measuring his history of magic homework. Professor Binns had asked for a 3-foot-long composition on the medieval assembly of European wizards.
"I don't believe it. I'm still 8 inches short," said Ron, furiously letting go of his parchment, which sprang back into a roll. "And Hermione's done 4 feet 7 inches, and her writing's tiny."
"Where is she?" asked Harry, grabbing the tape measure and unrolling his own homework.
"Somewhere over there," said Ron, pointing along the shelves. "Looking for another book. I think she's trying to read the whole library before Christmas."
Harry told Ron about Justin Finch-Fletchley running away from him.
"Don't know why you care. I thought he was a bit of an idiot," said Ron, scribbling away, making his writing as large as possible. "All that junk about Lockhart being so great."
Hermione emerged from between the bookshelves. She looked irritable and at last seemed ready to talk to them.
"All the copies of Hogwarts, a history, have been taken out," she said, sitting down next to Harry and Ron. "And there's a 2-week waiting list. I wish I hadn't left my copy at home, but I couldn't fit it in my trunk with all the Lockhart books."
"Why do you want it?" said Harry.
"The same reason everyone else wants it," said Hermione, "to read up on the legend of the Chamber of Secrets."
"What's that?" said Harry quickly.
"That's just it. I can't remember," said Hermione, biting her lip. "And I can't find the story anywhere else."
"Hermione, let me read your composition," said Ron, desperately checking his watch.
"No, I won't," said Hermione, suddenly severe. "You've had 10 days to finish it. I only need another 2 inches. Come on."
The bell rang. Ron and Hermione led the way to History of Magic, bickering. History of Magic was the dullest subject on their schedule,
Professor Binns, who taught it, was their only ghost teacher, and the most exciting thing that ever happened in his classes was his entering the room through the blackboard. Ancient and shriveled, many people said he hadn't noticed he was dead. He had simply got up to teach one day and left his body behind him in an armchair in front of the staff room fire. His routine had not varied in the slightest since. Today was as boring as ever. Professor Binns opened his notes and began to read in a flat drone, like an old vacuum cleaner, until nearly everyone in the class was in a deep stupor, occasionally coming to long enough to copy down a name or date, then falling asleep again. He had been speaking for half an hour when something happened that had never happened before. Hermione put up her hand. Professor Binns, glancing up in the middle of a deadly dull lecture on the International Warlock Convention of 1289, looked amazed.
Miss Granger, Professor, I was wondering if you could tell us anything about the Chamber of Secrets, said Hermione in a clear voice.
Dean Thomas, who had been sitting with his mouth hanging open, gazing out of the window, jerked out of his trance. Lavender Brown's head came up off her arms, and Neville Longbottom's elbow slipped off his desk. Professor Binns blinked.
"My subject is history of magic,"
he said in his dry, wheezy voice.
"I deal with facts, Miss Granger, not myths and legends."
He cleared his throat with a small noise like chalk snapping, and continued.
"In September of that year, a subcommittee of Sardinian sorcerers..."
He stuttered to a halt. Hermione's hand was waving in the air again.
"Miss Grant?"
"Please, sir, don't legends always have a basis in fact?"
Professor Binns was looking at her in such amazement. Harry was sure no student had ever interrupted him before, alive or dead.
"Well,"
said Professor Binns slowly,
"yes, one could argue that, I suppose."
He peered at Hermione as though he had never seen a student properly before.
"However, the legend of which you speak is such a very sensational, even ludicrous tale."
But the whole class was now hanging on Professor Binns's every word. He looked dimly at them all, every face turned to his. Harry could tell he was completely thrown by such an unusual show of interest.
"Oh, very well,"
he said slowly.
"Let me see. The Chamber of Secrets. You all know, of course, that Hogwarts was founded over 1,000 years ago. The precise date is uncertain. By the 4 greatest witches and wizards of the age. The 4 schoolhouses are named after them. Godric Gryffindor, Helga Hufflepuff, Rowena Ravenclaw, and Salazar Slytherin. They built this castle together, far from prying muggle eyes, for it was an age when magic was feared by common people, and witches and wizards suffered much persecution."
He paused, gazed blearily around the room, and continued.
"For a few years, the founders worked in harmony together, seeking out youngsters who showed signs of magic and bringing them to the castle to be educated. But then disagreements sprang up between them. A rift began to grow between Slytherin and the others. Slytherin wished to be more selective about the students admitted to Hogwarts. He believed that magical learning should be kept within all magic families. He disliked taking students of muggle parentage, believing them to be untrustworthy. After a while, there was a serious argument on the subject between Slytherin and Gryffindor, and Slytherin left the school."
Professor Binns paused again, pursing his lips, looking like a wrinkled old tortoise.
"Reliable historical sources tell us this much," he said, "but these honest facts have been obscured by the fanciful legend of the Chamber of Secrets. The story goes that Slytherin had built a hidden chamber in the castle of which the other founders knew nothing.
Slytherin, according to the legend, sealed the Chamber of Secrets so that none would be able to open it until his own true heir arrived at the school. The heir alone would be able to unseal the Chamber of Secrets, unleash the horror within, and use it to purge the school of all who were unworthy to study magic.
There was silence as he finished telling the story. But it wasn't the usual sleepy silence that filled Professor Binns's classes. There was unease in the air as everyone continued to watch him, hoping for more. Professor Binns looked faintly annoyed.
"The whole thing is arrant nonsense, of course," he said. "Naturally, the school has been searched for evidence of such a chamber many times by the most learned witches and wizards. It does not exist. A tale told to frighten the gullible."
Hermione's hand was back in the air.
"Sir, what exactly do you mean by the horror within the chamber?" "That is believed to be some sort of monster which the heir of Slytherin alone can control,"
said Professor Binns in his dry, reedy voice. The class exchanged nervous looks.
"I tell you, the thing does not exist,"
said Professor Binns, shuffling his notes.
"There is no chamber and no monster."
"But, sir," said Seamus Finnegan, "if the chamber can only be opened by Slytherin's true heir, no one else would be able to find it, would they?"
"Nonsense, oh flattery,"
said Professor Binns in an aggravated tone.
"If a long succession of Hogwarts headmasters and headmistresses haven't found a thing..."
"But, Professor," piped up Parvati Patil, "you'd probably have to use dark magic to open it."
"Just because a wizard doesn't use dark magic doesn't mean he can't, Miss Pennyfeather,"
snapped Professor Binns.
"I repeat, if the likes of Dumbledore..."
"But maybe you've got to be related to Slytherin, so Dumbledore couldn't," began Dean Thomas, but Professor Binns had had enough.
"That will do," he said sharply. "It's a myth. It does not exist. There is not a shred of evidence that Slytherin ever built so much as a secret broom cupboard. I regret telling you such a foolish story. We will return, if you please, to history, to solid, believable, verifiable fact."
And within 5 minutes, the class had sunk back into its usual torpor.
"I always knew Salazar Slytherin was a twisted old loony," Ron told Harry and Hermione as they fought their way through the teeming corridors at the end of the lesson to drop off their bags before dinner. "But I never knew he started all this pure blood stuff. I wouldn't be in his house if you paid me. Honestly, if the Sorting Hat had tried to put me in Slytherin, I'd have got the train straight back home." Hermione nodded fervently, but Harry didn't say anything. His stomach had just dropped unpleasantly. Harry had never told Ron and Hermione that the Sorting Hat had seriously considered putting him in Slytherin. He could remember, as though it were yesterday, the small voice that had spoken in his ear when he'd placed the hat on his head a year before.
"You could be great, you know. It's all here in your head, and Slytherin would help you on your way to greatness. No doubt about that."
But Harry, who had already heard of Slytherin's house reputation for turning out dark wizards, had thought desperately, "Not Slytherin." And the hat had said,
"Oh, well, if you're sure, better be Gryffindor."
As they were shunted along in the throng, Colin Creevy went past.
"Hi, Harry."
"Hello, Colin," said Harry automatically.
Harry, a boy in my class has been saying you're..."
But Colin was so small he couldn't fight against the tide of people bearing him toward the great hall. They heard him squeak,
"See you, Harry,"
and he was gone.
"What's a boy in his class saying about you?"
Hermione wondered.
"That I'm Slytherin's heir, I expect," said Harry, his stomach dropping another inch or so, as he suddenly remembered the way Justin Finch-Fletchley had run away from him at lunchtime.
"People here will believe anything," said Ron in disgust. The crowd thinned, and they were able to climb the next staircase without difficulty.
"Do you really think there's a Chamber of Secrets?"
Ron asked Hermione.
I don't know, she said, frowning. Dumbledore couldn't cure Mrs. Norris, and that makes me think that whatever attacked her might not be, well, human.
As she spoke, they turned a corner and found themselves at the end of the very corridor where the attack had happened. They stopped and looked. The scene was just as it had been that night, except that there was no stiff cat hanging from the torch bracket, and an empty chair stood against the wall bearing the message, "The Chamber of Secrets has been opened."
"That's where Filch has been keeping guard," Ron muttered.
They looked at each other. The corridor was deserted.
"Can't hurt to have a poke around," said Harry, dropping his bag and getting to his hands and knees so he could crawl along, searching for clues. "Scorch marks," he said. "Here and here. Come and look at this."